Now the next segment is why we really lured you here. David's going to tell you how you can help with their fight, which I think is one of that's the reason. You know very well. I invite no speakers here whatsoever because of the danger of somebody coming here with these wild theories that go all through this movement and lead people astray. But when I saw what David and Herb have done, which in my estimation is a milestone, I called David up and offered him to come here and to help his cause. Because I think it's a just cause. It's a cause we should all get in because this is the basis of the attack on the church. This is the basis. This was set in place by Roosevelt with his socialism, where slowly but surely the government became God. This is where we got to go back. We got to rebuff this. We got to stop it before it's too late. So in that cause, we'll let David explain how you can help.
I'm going to mark it when you get out.
Oh, by the way, after David gets through, we will take questions and answers. We're going to set a mic up right in here.
Right, we'll break at the bottom of the hour.
We'll break at the bottom and set a mic up here. You have a question, please, let's do it orderly. Come up to the mic and ask your question.
Okay, I'm going to clap this, wait about 10 seconds, and we're rolling.
First of all, what I'm going to do is tell you what I'm going to say we. I'm going to say we, and I'll explain why. Right now, there's a lot of I. There's a lot of me typing, me talking to people on the phone. We had a rescue. A lady has come to this conviction the other day. She called me and said, what do I do? And she just was kind of, she lost her job all this week. Lost her job, lost a whole bunch of things. And we've got a family in our fellowship that is housing this lady, give her a chance to let the dust settle and really sort out her convictions and figure out what the Lord wants for her. So there's some rescue things that are going on. People call me from around the country and they say, this is what happens. My Christian bosses are going to fire me. I've showed them all the IRS forms, everything like that. They don't understand, and they're telling me that they're going to have to fire me. What do I do? I want to sue them. And then I give them biblical counseling. Well, is that what God wants you to do? And the counsel I gave this one lady is, after talking to her, what you need to do is love your boss, pray for your boss, go home, talk to your husband, and earnestly pray what God's desire is for your life and how that he might be able to bless and maybe give understanding to your employer. Well, it turns out she came in on Monday ready to take her stuff home off of her desk. On Friday evening, an IRS agent had given this employer Pub 1586, which shows his due diligence requirements, how he doesn't have to fire his employee if she won't give a number. So on Monday morning, she came in and found out she still had a job. It's Pub 1586, but we'll wait for Q&A, okay? Write those down. Another instance, I'll give you an example. A gentleman in Illinois has got the same convictions. His bank told him they were going to have to get rid of him as a customer. And he said, the bank regulators are coming. He said, if I can't give him something, show him why he should stay there, he's going to lose his business banking account. So what I did is I interviewed him to find out whether it was really, truly religious convictions or a political reason, what his background was. Well, this guy, and I've spent a lot of time over the phone, many hours, over several months, and I'm absolutely convinced this is absolutely religious conviction. So I wrote a letter to the bank explaining his convictions, his affiliation with our society, that yes, he is. This is our biblical basis, and also I explained the Crime Enforcement Network, Treasury Department's instructions on how he could keep his bank account, and we also cited the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And then I admonished him to allow this gentleman who's standing just like Daniel did in the Bible, and how Daniel's stance affected the entire nation of Babylon because he was true to God first. The entire nation was blessed, and I encouraged the bank officer that he would allow the same favor to this member of our fellowship. And sure enough, they showed it to the bank examiners, and the guy still has his bank account. Now, this letter here is September 23rd. My heart, my vision is to minister to my brethren, to preach the kingdom, to preach faith. So I do. In fact, I've written a book, Faith, the Final Frontier, and I give it to people. And I just, you know, this might identify with what's going on in your life. There's a hint about what happened in the Navy there. Because the message is to know what God's will is, to do it, and then stand back and watch the mighty salvation of God. So I've got this book there. It's available to you. If somebody does want to give a gift, it goes into a pot so we can reprint them. Okay? That's your prerogative. But really what I'm here for is to let you know what the ministry, the vision that I've got, and the way you can help me. What I've done is I've made a brochure. It talks about what we've started as the American Christian Liberty Society. Right now, with Larry Lewis's case, I asked Herb, and I said, Herb, Larry's case is my case. Larry's case is everybody else's case. It really is. Now, at the time, I knew I had a check coming in front of the government, so I knew I could be a guarantor to a certain point. I mean, I have some debts to pay that were accrued during that time of fighting. And some of those, and we had to go on a big vacation. We did that. I've got daughter and son in college. All that kind of stuff is done. So there's a point at which my personal resources are right at the end. And Larry's case right now is already costing us above that. Larry's case now will continue to cost us more. What if it has to go to the United States Supreme Court and then come back down to the Idaho court? All that kind of stuff goes on. So it could take many tens of thousands of dollars. So, and our hope is, as we're helping Larry, there's a provision in that statute, if he prevails, that we'll get our money back and it'll go back into the pot. Then we can feed Herb and some other associate or somebody who's working hard for maybe the guy in Texas. And then when we win there, we can get our money back in the pot. And while we're working the next case, we can feed Herb or his associate or whoever it is while they're working, and eventually the money will come back to the pot. So if you will give, if you will consider giving to ACLS Trust, when the money goes in the trust, it's not feeding me. Okay, I might be working. I'll do my little paralegal gopher stuff. But really, mine is a ministry. I have a ministry, Freedom Ministries, which I've just started this month, to do speaking engagements. I've got a little flyer there. If you'd like me to invite me to your church to come speak, I'm surviving off of faith gifts in that area. But as far as we're here to talk about the American Christian Liberty Society Trust. And if you would consider giving to this trust, what it's going to do, it's going to pay Herb and his travel and any other costs that we have to keep this fight going in Idaho, and do it well. Do it systematically. Do it right. And even if we lose there, sometimes a loss is a good thing. Sometimes when it gets really bad, people start to take notice. Remember the Ten Commandments issues? It started to get really bad, and suddenly, all of a sudden, all these courts are starting to reverse their perspective on whether there should be a Ten Commandments display. So sometimes a loss is a win, but it takes a lot of hard work. So my daughter asked me today, are you still working on law, Daddy? Honey, I think I'm going to be doing it for another 20 years, maybe. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. Now, so there's these things. Herb has some books back there that you can buy, God, Man, and Law, the Biblical Principles. There's some tape series, Common Law of the Family, and there's one other issue there. But there's other books you can consider, but the reason we're here is to talk about the American Christian Liberty Society, and I think there was one more thing. Oh, yes, I have an anecdote, and then I'm going to turn it over to Herb. Then we're going to do question and answer. Herb said that we were sent back to the lower court from the appeals court back down to the Court of Claims, and we were on our way to Washington to discuss how to proceed. It was a procedural discussion, purely logistical. And we're driving to Washington, D.C. to talk to him in person because Herb didn't trust the court. So on the way up, I'm explaining things. He's just, revisit everything for me, David. Start from the beginning. So I'm revisiting everything. And then there was this one critical day where there's a document I had to sign so I could move on to my next duty station, shore duty. And it was an obligated service document. They gave me the wrong document because I knew if they gave me the wrong document, it may be considered invalid later. They were setting me up for a fall. But this thing cited that I was obligating my service. Well, that thing, it's just a military. This is not really a contract kind of agreement. I agree to do this or don't agree to do that. There has to be an authority for me signing that paper. And that authority required me to continue service for 2 years, and it also required the Navy to give me service for 2 years. It was the Secretary of the Navy's authority, and all I was doing was kind of signing one of those acknowledgement kind of forms. It's really what it was. So it took me a half hour. I got to the story, and it took me a half hour. He just kept have me go back and explain all those regulations. And so that was kind of weird. That's not what we're going to Washington, D.C. for. But so we get up there, we have lunch, we have a little prayer time. And he says, David, where was that in the record, that thing you told me about? And it was page 317. I said, I don't know, let me look. Oh, it's page 317. He walks in the courtroom with this number, page 317, on his brain. And while he's talking to the judge about how they're supposed to be able to proceed, and the judge brings up this his own motion for dismissal, he said, but Mr. Carmichael was finished with his obligated service. The Navy had no requirement to pay him another day. Didn't he finish his obligated service? And he starts making this motion to throw it out of his own court because of lack of jurisdiction. But what had happened? The Lord had given Herb page 317 in the record. Before we walked into the courtroom, that's what he had on his mind. It had nothing to do with what we were going to be talking about there. So you could see him shaking because he was mad at the judge for doing a curveball on him like that. You know, I'm thinking, page 317, he was just kind of getting his composure over what the judge was doing. And he said, no, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, Mr. Carmichael had an obligation to serve the Navy for two more years. If you look on page 317, and all of a sudden the judge's face just melted, and he's just frustrated. What was really neat is that was just one example of many other examples where we could see the mighty hand of God coming at the right time, at the right place, with the right document, with the right little bit of wisdom, just when we need it at most. So I just want to encourage you in that I don't think this is just about us. I actually think we're doing what we're supposed to. And so I think God's in it, and I'm just inviting you to come join us. Thank you.
Well, that was not the only time that God gave us a particular document in that exhibit, which, if I I want to remind you, was the government's exhibit, not our exhibit. It was their exhibit. There was another page that came up in the final analysis with regard to that. Let me go back to a point that I think is extremely important for us to understand, and again, it goes back to the authority question. We live under a constitution that establishes a federal republic. Now, today, you know, people talk about America is a democracy. Well, it's just simply not true, as you know, right up there, that this is a it is a federal republic. Now, the federalist principle is extremely important because what we have to remember in the history of America is that the states came before the United States of America. Virginia became a state before the nation was chartered. As a matter of fact, Virginia ratified a constitution 1 month before the Declaration of Independence. And Pennsylvania established its government 1 month after the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence is a charter of the nation, but it is not a constitution. It wasn't designed to be a constitution. As a matter of fact, there was a discussion and a debate amongst those who founded the country whether to have a constitutional government at the United States level or whether to have a Confederate alliance that is more like a treaty among the states. So there's a great debate over that issue. So it's important to remember that the governments of the states were established before the United States government was established. As a matter of fact, if you look at the history, you'll see that two of the 13 original states, Rhode Island and Connecticut, never enacted a constitution. They established themselves as a state under their charter. As a matter of fact, if you look at the Connecticut license plate, if you've been to Connecticut lately, you will see it says the Constitution State. Why does it say the Constitution State? Well, because the 16, I can't remember, but it was a 17th century document. A 17th century document established the Constitution of Connecticut. Now, why is this important? It's important because in order for the federal government to act, in order for the United States government to act, they have to demonstrate that they have authority to act. A state government, because of the nature of the state government, is they're presumed to have all the authority that a civil government has. But the United States government is only a government of numerated powers. Now, John has written about this because I got to see He gave me a copy of his book, and it's important for us to remember that, that this is a federal system. Now, why is this relevant with regard to a, quote, national ID? The United States government doesn't have any authority to impose upon the people of the United States a identifying number. They have no such authority. Now, this is why, if you look at all of the statutes, the federal statutes, they all basically get the states to give that identifying number. So if you go back to that 66613, what is it? Well, the United States government says, since we're providing money for your welfare system, states, then we can require as a condition for your getting federal money that you require someone who obtains a license of any kind to put the Social Security number on. Now notice, a state could say, I'm not going to do that. You know, keep your old money. Well, there are not very many state governments that will do that today, but the whole point is that the federal government can't force the states to adopt the SSN or any other number as an identifying number. They can't do that. And they can't do it themselves. So you take the Real ID Act, and what do? They say, if you want to get federal benefits, then you have to have this kind of a state identification system. Notice, once again, they can't require either the people of the United States or the state to do that, but what do? They say, well, if you don't do that, then we'll deny you federal benefits. For example, one of the things they say is that if you don't have this Real ID number issued to you by the state, then you can't get on an airplane. Why? Because we run the Department of Transportation that screens you before you can get onto the airplane. Now, that doesn't mean that the state has to establish a Real ID number. As a matter of fact, you know what a state could do? Is they could establish a two-tier system and say, okay, those of you who want to get federal benefits, this is the kind of license you can have. But those of you who don't want them, this is the kind of license you have. Now, in New Hampshire, if you were following it earlier this year, the New Hampshire legislature was actually toying with the idea that they would not establish a Real ID in New Hampshire. Now, whether or not they'll follow through with that is another question. But again, what's important is to recognize that the federal system, albeit, watered down or almost destroyed, still is there. But what's important is that the people of the United States act that way. We need to act that way and say, hey, look, first and foremost are the state governments, and only secondarily is the United States government. Too often, and I know I find myself doing this, is I think that the state government or the federal government's primary and the state government's secondary, and I'm just simply wrong. I have to remember I was taught that. I went to Harvard Law School. So I have to shed that, you know. I have to say, now, wait a minute, that isn't right. I've got to do it the right way rather than the way I was taught, right? Isn't that right? This is the problem with lawyers, is that they have to unlearn a lot of things. So if you ever go to law school, be careful. So it's important for us, when we live in a system, to behave that way. Now, why is that important? Because the battle with regard to the Real ID number is in every one of the state legislatures. That's where the battle is.
Microphone.
Oh, I did it again.
You're blowing his ears out.
I know. I'm so sorry. I'm a little excited. Okay. So it's important, and I don't know about Maryland. You know what we call Maryland down in Virginia. I don't know what the... but don't give up, you know. Find somebody in the state legislature. There must be some people in the state legislature who are concerned about this principle. I know there are at least a couple of people, if there are not more. And, of course, you've got an election this year. It's important, isn't it, to see that the delegates understand these principles, and it's important for us to urge them to make the right kinds of decisions. Now, again, let me say to you, so going back to that 66613, which says that you have to have an SSN on all these license applications, if the government has to prove a compelling interest, guess what they have to show? They have to show that if they make an exception for someone who has a religious objection, it would threaten the whole state for the loss of federal money, when that's only one factor in a whole host of factors. Remember it says subsection 13? Well, there's subsection 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. There are all these things, and it's only one out of all of these things. So how can the government show a compelling interest? Again, going back to the state statute that protects freedom of religion and going to the state constitution first rather than going to the United States Constitution. Let me give you another example. I once was helping someone represent a person down in Texas fighting the no-fault divorce statute. And we took the position that the no-fault divorce statute is an unconstitutional establishment of religion because it gives total jurisdiction over a marriage to a civil court. Yeah. Under the fault system, it was a limited authority of the civil government. They were limited to those instances where you could prove fault. You know that today's family court is a ecclesiastical court. The problem is an ecclesiastical court that is basically secular and anti-God, but nonetheless assumes all of the powers of an ecclesiastical court. So we argued this on the basis of the Texas Constitution. Now, by God's grace, we won one vote on a three-judge panel in the Court of Appeals on that point. A judge actually agreed with us that the no-fault divorce statute in Texas violated the Texas protection of religious freedom. We took it up to the Supreme Court of Texas, hoping that we would get a hearing, and didn't get a hearing. But we have the seed of a challenge that ultimately could be brought, a seed at the state level. And it's important for us to remember that the state constitutions are first. Now, I carry around a document that has the United States Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. I also have another document that is the Virginia Constitution, because I reside in Virginia. I need, everywhere I go, because our practice is nationwide, to have a state constitution wherever I am. And I confess to you, I didn't think about bringing the Maryland state constitution tonight. I should have, because we need to remember that we are first and foremost citizens of the state, and only secondarily citizens. And I know that this is a debatable question, too, in terms of what it means and so forth. So I'm being very, very careful. John's right next to me, and he's about ready to tackle me. But the whole point is we have relationship between with the state government and the United States government, and it's important for us to understand the difference between those relationships and the primacy of the state relationship in our lives. And it's reflected in this battle that we're involved in, that we can't just think that everything that affects us happens in Washington, D.C., but that we must be very active at the state, local levels if we're going to preserve the freedoms that God would have us preserve.